State versus ATC, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Don DeWard, Assistant Deputy Public Defender.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jennifer Kamisiak, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the state.
Good afternoon, counsel. Please go ahead, Mr. DeWard.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve about 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. The JLA, Jessica Lunsford Act, subsection D violates the separation of powers clause on its face because the power invests in the prosecutor to set a prison term and parole ineligibility period is unreviewable by sentencing courts. Moreover, it is incommensurable with this court's approach in Vasquez, reconciling similarly facially unconstitutional statutes with the separation of powers clause. Their AG guidelines were required to assist prosecutorial decision-making, and the prosecutor must state on the record reasons for the decision to waive or decline to waive. The statewide Brennidge guidelines provided a matrix for computing sentence ranges so they serve the uniformity goal and provide a basis for the court to determine whether the prosecutor's sentence is arbitrary and capricious. Nothing of the sort is accomplished with the abbreviated guidelines for justifying the sentence reduction decision of subsection D. As the state notes, because the focus of the JLA is on the interests of the victim, that's crucial here, the prosecutor's reasoning may be based on confidential information. This differentiates the Brennidge guidelines from these guidelines. Reasons for neither the decision to reduce the sentence nor the specific sentence can be placed on the record. But if so, then subsection D is unconstitutional. It cannot be interpreted as in Vasquez because reasons cannot be placed on the record. Indeed, subsection D is silent on whether the prosecutor must place on the record her reasons for the reduction decision or the sentence. Nothing in the process permits judicial review. The only discretion the court has is whether to accept or to reject the plea, and if it accepts the plea, the prosecutor's sentence must be imposed. But even this degree of discretion weakens considerably the power of the sentencing court. As the state points out, unlike Brennidge, the guidelines here are not about quantifiable facts. Essentially, they're a checklist with a focus on the victim. The outcome is significant sentencing variations among the counties applying the JLA, and we've done some research and discovered some of that variation among the counties and courts. Subsection D cannot be found unconstitutional independently of the JLA as a whole. The legislature explicitly intended to motivate plea bargaining in the victim's interest. It is a measure of restorative justice, in fact. And this court cannot, without itself violating the separation of powers doctrine, excise a section of the JLA that was there from the beginning. Either the JLA as a whole must be found unconstitutional, or subsection D must be interpreted in such a way as in Vasquez as to render it consistent with the separation of powers doctrine. Now, I thought about this. One possibility is for there to be an in-camera hearing at which only attorneys and the judge would be provided with the prosecutor's reasons and the record would be sealed. And guidelines must also be linked to sentencing ranges as in Brennidge, but they are not here. That would at least permit a judge to determine whether the initial decision and sentence is arbitrary and capricious. Now the relief we asked for ATC, since this was, in our view, an unconstitutional statute, subsection D, until this court resolves the constitutional question, at resentencing, ATC should be sentenced within the standard NERA sentencing range. That concludes my statement.
If the purpose of a statement of reasons is to ensure that not only is the statute and the regulations being followed, but to ensure that there is uniform application of this law across the state. How is the sealing of the record going to accomplish that? I mean, the whole purpose of a public hearing and also disclosure of the statement of reasons is so, number one, the world and the public can be assured of the integrity of the proceedings, but also to make available to other defendants and defense counsel whether or not there are disparate rulings in different parts of the state or even in the same county. You following me?
Yes, I grant that could actually be a problem, and in that case I would say it's just simply unconstitutional. However, I think it could also be, one response to that is that even in Brinage, it isn't a specific defendant whose Brinage calculation goes statewide that renders the guidelines and the practices uniform. The guidelines themselves can do that, and especially if they're linked. There's nothing about the guidelines, especially if they're linked to sentencing ranges, that would themselves violate the confidentiality of the victim.
You're asking us to find the statute unconstitutional.
Yes.
Okay. And you're saying send it back for a resentencing. But if we find the statute unconstitutional, perhaps there could be no resentencing. Would we send it back for a trial? Could that also occur as opposed to a resentencing?
Or not necessarily a trial, or a...
But it could be a trial, too.
It could be a trial, okay. And it could also be a plea bargain. The prosecutor might still offer a plea bargain. That would be a risk that the defendant would have to take. But here the plea bargain would not be under the JLA. So the maximum sentence would be 20 years. And it would have to be somewhere between 10 and 20 following the standard sentencing procedures for a NERA sentence.
You said alternatively, if I understood you correctly, that the statute could be made constitutional if it comported with Vasquez and the authority.
And I was only, yes, Your Honor, and I was only suggesting the in-camera hearing as a possible route. And it may not work out to accomplish the uniformity, and if it doesn't, then that would close that route off.
So if we were to go with the alternative approach, statement of reasons, and a more fulsome set of guidelines,
yes.
Would your argument as to the statement of reasons apply as well to the decision by the prosecutor not to waive?
Thought about that too.
Tell us what you think.
Yes, and I think the judge would then be able to assess using those reasons presented in camera for that specific case whether that was an arbitrary decision by the prosecutor.
Well, doesn't that presume that you're entitled to waiver and that the range is actually wider than the legislature has set otherwise to be 25 to life?
I don't see my argument as implying that it's an entitlement. I don't think it is. I think the statute is very clear about that, but it's also clear that there is a strong inference or a strong desire by the legislature to make that something available not to the defendant but to the victim for the victim's interests.
You're struggling with where the line belongs in terms of the separation of the authority of the branches.
Yes.
Tell us why it should be, under the extended argument, that the courts would review every decision by a prosecutor not to seek waiver. Would that be an overreach in the opposite direction?
I would have to say, I understand your question. I'm a little, frankly, I can't right now think of a principled way to draw that distinction so that the judge would not have an opportunity to review the reasons against the waiver.
Haven't we said that in past? Tell me if I'm mistaken. I thought we've already trod this ground. Haven't we said that in a scheme like this, where there's waiver, that there has to be a statement of reasons why the prosecutor is not waiving? How else would we be able to determine the consistent application of the statute otherwise?
And that's why I agreed that that would be the only principled thing to do, as far as I can think right now, for the judge to have the power to assess the reasons for not waiving as
but,
well.
But we've done this before in other statutes, PTI.
Yes.
The whole Brimage guidelines is premised upon that too.
Absolutely.
But this is slightly different. Mm-hmm. You don't have an application being made in this case. This is the prosecution making an internal determination. Do I extend this?
Well, I think in Vasquez too, the reasons to be given are the reasons whether or not to waive, and it's not an application exactly. It's not like 43.6F, not Lagares. It's a similar kind of solution. It's the decision of the prosecutor to waive or not waive the minimum term. And in that case too, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the prosecutor, does have to give the reasons not to waive.
Yeah, I'm looking at a quotation from Vasquez. Judicial oversight is mandated to protect against arbitrary and capricious prosecutorial decisions. To that end, the prosecutor should state on the record the reasons for the decision to waive or the refusal to waive
Yes. The
parole disqualifier.
Right.
I mean, so we've been here before.
Yes. I think that part of Vasquez should apply here, and in fact, Vasquez should apply wherever it's applicable.
I don't know why I'm having such trouble with this, but I can't help but see the Vasquez situation as being different here. And let me just explain why.
Yes.
you can disabuse me of this concern. Here the legislature has set the range as 25 to life and gives the prosecutor the ability, if the prosecutor wishes, to enter into a plea below that range on certain conditions that seem to focus on concern mostly for the victim.
Yes.
In Vasquez, you have a range that's set by the legislature that includes the mandatory minimum.
Mm-hmm.
That's the range never changes. It's just simply how much of the time has to be served that we're talking about in Vasquez, and the prosecutor has the ability to say, I'm not going to make you do the one-third or one-half or whatever the fraction turns out to be in your particular case. It strikes me as something different in kind from changing the range that we're dealing with here for plea bargain purposes.
I think that Vasquez has to be read in connection with respect to 3512 with Brimage. And Brimage, in fact, came about because of Vasquez. And these are guidelines that do require the prosecutor to put reasons for specific sentencing ranges on the record, presumably to satisfy the requirements of Vasquez's requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I...
When you're deviating from the Brimage framework, yes, you have to set reasons on the record, and you have to get rid of that Section 12 that used to permit inter-county special rules that promoted or permitted disparities, right? That's what Brimage was concerned about.
Yes, and Brimage provides the reasons in a very fine-tuned sort of way.
Right. That doesn't quite fit here, though, does it?
Well, why couldn't there be guidelines that are linked to sentencing ranges between the 10 and 25? Permitted by the downward departure of the plea bargaining.
The legislature has set the range at 25 to life.
Well, the original range, yes, the statute's initial range is 25 to life.
Right.
But if the prosecutor wants to enter into a plea, offer a plea bargain in the interests of the victim, then the range can be anywhere from 15 to 25.
Right.
And here, no reasons were given for 20 or any other sentence, and the counties we've looked at and it's not a very large body of cases, but the counties we've looked at have very different sentences between 15 and 25.
One last question. Isn't the Brimage requirement of giving a reason for deviating from a very specific framework a different explanation than insisting that the prosecutor explain why he or she has picked, let's assume it's past indictment, so you're now within that 18 to 25-year range, why they pick 19 versus 23 to offer to the defendant? I mean, we are intruding into an area that's entrusted to the discretion of the prosecutor, subject to lack of an abuse of discretion, I suppose. Why would we as a judicial branch want to second guess that very fine judgment by the prosecutor?
But if the prosecutor makes a mistake in the Brimage calculation, then the defendant can point that out and the judge can make can assess that outcome and make a determination whether that's a correct sentencing range, or even specific sentence.
I take it that based on Legarra's, Vasquez, Brimage, the whole purpose of the statement of reasons, to waive or not to waive, is to permit judicial review.
Yes.
To ensure that there isn't disparate sentencing. Because one of the preeminent goals of the code is uniformity in sentencing. If we don't perform that task, then we're not carrying out probably the major purpose of the Code of Criminal Justice.
Yes, and there's no chance for review here in subsection D. The prosecutor has complete control over the assessment of the factors, and in fact, it's confidential and can't even be shared with the court, presumably, unless there's some kind of option I've suggested in camera. But here, there's no way for the court to review the decision, either the decision to reduce in a plea bargain, reduce below 25 down to.
But the judge can never do so. The restrictions here are really stringent, I don't see how they help the defendant, because if the judge were to kick a plea bargain, let's take this 20 years. Because the judge thinks he should get 18, he's not doing the defendant a favor by kicking the 20-year plea bargain and sending him to trial where he's going to be exposed to 25 for life. So it doesn't. The way this is structured, there's very little relief for the defendant, other than at least a statement of reasons to ensure that prosecutors are uniformly applying the statute. Am I off about this?
No, I think you're right. I think that there has to be some uniformity of reasoning here across the state, and I think that there is a possibility that the plea could be exploded, and.
The judge can always kick it out for one of two reasons. He doesn't think that it's tough enough, or he thinks it's not benefiting the defendant enough. But if he's not thinking it's not benefiting, there's nothing he can really do for the defendant anyway. Because kicking the plea is only going to be sending the defendant to trial.
Yes.
Following me?
Yes.
Tell us from the public defender's perspective what you've seen in terms of uniformity among the counties.
I'll just give you. This is based on an email from the sentencing attorney. There were about six cases. About six cases, and Essex County had one case 20 years, one 21 years, one 15 years. Gloucester County, two for 15 years. Hudson County, 15 years. Hunterdon County, 15 years. Ocean County, 15 years. Somerset County, 25 years, but that was post-indictment. I don't know if that was just the JLA or some hybrid of the subsection B in the JLA. And Warren County, 20 years. Tyler, and another case in Warren, 15 years. And those are only people who were at Avenel that Mr. Keyes was able to detect. And we don't have the JLCs, but we can get those for the court, of course, and extend the research.
But the trending is, once they take, they agree to a plea, that the prosecutors are accepting, are offering somewhere from 15 to 18 years at the bottom end.
I would say 15 to 20 more often.
Okay.
With, I think, one at 21.
How much detail is really necessary? You know, you began with your discussion of an in-camera hearing with just attorneys present, but is it enough for a meaningful judicial review if the prosecutor says to the court, the victim is 15, 14, 9, it would be, in our judgment, detrimental to her progress in school, her mental health, whatever it may be, for her to go through a trial, have to testify, without getting into specifics of whether she has a mental health issue or what her educational records are, whatever it may be. Why isn't that enough to have meaningful judicial review, and given the fact that her identity is not going to be publicly known, wouldn't that protect the confidentiality of the victim?
Well, first of all, it I think under the JLA has to be under 13. But
I'm sorry, 13. Yeah, I meant younger. I should.
That would be some reasons for the prosecutor entering into the plea agreement. But it wouldn't, in fact, in cases where the prosecutor chooses not to, for example, mm-hmm. enter into a plea agreement. It wouldn't take care of those cases,
right.
Because
the prosecutor
would have to provide reasons.
What if the prosecutor then said, on the flip side of that, told the court that this she's now 15, she's now 16, she's ready to testify, she's prepared to go ahead, she wants to see, she's hopeful that the defendant will be found guilty and sentenced accordingly. What if that sort of generic statement were made? I mean, what I'm trying to get at is, why would there have to be exposure of someone's really private records in any event for the purposes of this judicial review?
I think in that case, I think you do have the uniformity problem, because there would be significant variation among counties, presumably. There would be no way to control those variations as there is in with 3512 and Brimage. So I think there would be wide variation among the counties. That would depend to a large extent on the prosecutor involved, the facts about the county, as a matter of fact. So that wouldn't accomplish the uniformity goal.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Kamisiak.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. By passing the Jessica Lunsford Act in 2014, New Jersey became the 46th state to increase the penalties for sexual offenses against our most vulnerable victims, young children under the age of 13. New Jersey statute is somewhat unique from those across the country in that it does allow this negotiated reduction from the otherwise mandatory 25 years, all without parole, down to a minimum of 15 years in consideration of the interests of the victim. The legislature recognized the need for uniformity in prosecutorial decision-making and required the Attorney General to develop guidelines to assist prosecutors in determining the amount of reduction to be offered, if any, under the Act. The Attorney General issued these guidelines and set forth factors for prosecutors to consider. But the guidelines make clear that the prosecutor's reasoned discretion still controls in every case, and latitude is afforded. These guidelines serve two important purposes. Number one, they channel prosecutorial discretion. And number two, they create a mechanism for effective judicial review of plea offers under the Act. Based on these two protections, this court in Vasquez rejected a similar separation of powers challenge to 2C35-12. The state asks this court to adopt that same analysis and hold the Jessica Lunsford Act does not violate separation of powers doctrine on its face. And with respect to this defendant, this court should also hold his sentence does not violate the separation of powers doctrine. The prosecutor below repeatedly made clear he had consulted the guidelines, followed the guidelines, consulted with the victim, balanced the relevant factors, and as a result, he gave defendant the benefit of 5 years off of the otherwise mandatory 25 years without parole, substantial leniency. Defendant is not entitled to demand maximum leniency, which is what he is really asking for, particularly without clearly and convincingly proving that the leniency he has already been given was somehow arbitrary or capricious. The starting point set by the legislature is 25 years. It is not 15 years from which the state must somehow justify an upward departure. In any event, the prosecutor here did justify the 20-year sentence by pointing to the harm to the victim and the overwhelming strength of the state's case. As the court is aware, defendant sexually abused his girlfriend's minor daughter, who he was a father figure to for many years, over a period of years. And this abuse came to light after defendant was arrested during a child pornography investigation. And in the course of that investigation, explicit video evidence demonstrated and proved the abuse in this case. These facts alone more than justify the 20-year plea offer. For these reasons, and those set forth more fully in the state's brief, the state asks this court to hold the Jessica Lunsford Act as both facially constitutional and constitutional as applied to this defendant.
Are you done with your opening
statement? I am, yes.
The level of detail in the different guidelines the Attorney General has promulgated is a bit striking. You have more than 100 pages for Brimage, mm-hmm. and the single paragraph for point two for these guidelines. Would you care to comment on the difference and the adequacy of the guidelines?
Yes. The guidelines in this case are more than adequate and appropriate, given that the legislature determined that this should be in consideration of the interest of the victim. This is not a defendant-focused statute where we can easily look at the amount of drugs and the objective facts of the crime necessarily. This is in the consideration of the interests of the victim. That's what the legislature declared and asked the Attorney General to develop guidelines on, and that is what the Attorney General did.
So how did the guidelines channel the discretion of the prosecutor as to where within the range of 15 to 25 years the sentence could be, aside from the plea escalation policy?
So they channeled the discretion of the prosecutor by setting forth factors A through H. Those are the relevant factors. They channel the prosecutor. The prosecutor should not be considering factors outside of this. So they channel and encourage uniformity by focusing prosecutors only on these available factors.
But how does that focus and address the question of uniformity? Looking at those factors, how would one know whether the sentence should be 7 years lower, 3 years lower, 1 year lower? I'm not clear how they channel discretion aside from the reference that it is in the reasoned discretion of the prosecutor.
I think what the Attorney General guidelines do is recognize that this prosecutors have wide discretion in many types of cases, and these are the types of factors that they would look at. It's not reducible to numeric value, and I don't think the legislature intended or this court should hold that the prosecutor has to come in and specifically justify a certain sentence to say 20 years is appropriate here, you know, and we're not giving 15. I don't think that's what would be required to make the statute constitutional. I think the uniformity is in channeling prosecutors to look at all the same factors. That doesn't mean that every defendant is going to get the same sentence, because these crimes are unique. These are crimes against young children. There's so many variables. Is the victim willing to testify? What is the age of the victim? The victim's family, the strength of the case. This case, for example, is unique. We have actually video evidence of the defendant sexually abusing the victim. So why would he get the minimum sentence? Why should he be entitled to maximum leniency? It's almost self-evident.
So approach it from a slightly different direction.
Sure.
Looking at point two and the manner in which it channels discretion, if 21 prosecutors in 21 counties looked at the identical set of facts, mm-hmm. what would channel the individual prosecutor's discretion in a way that you'd hope you'd have some level of uniformity and they'd all end up with roughly the same number? How does this guideline achieve that goal?
Yeah, it achieves that goal by making sure that prosecutors are only considering these factors and not considering other, you know, factors that are different or that are outside the guidelines. We don't want prosecutors having, you know, idiosyncratic views of a case. We want them to look at just these factors. And that is sufficient for uniformity. But even in State versus Benjamin, this court recognized that even under Brimage, there is the potential for some inter-county disparity, and that's acceptable. But I know defendant has raised this inter-county disparity argument, and I did want to address it because I just wanted to make clear that was never raised below as a basis for why this defendant's sentence was in any way inappropriate. That's something that's being raised now. That was never raised below. And I know defense counsel mentioned a number of cases. It doesn't seem like it's a huge amount. We're talking about a small amount of cases. So this is not like Brimage, where this court invalidated the guidelines that existed prior to Brimage because there was allowances for counties to do whatever they chose to do. This is not like Brimage at all. These are the factors that every prosecutor must consider in determining a plea offer under the Jessica Lunsford Act.
Can you tell us, is the Attorney General's office now keeping track of these cases with an eye toward uniformity? And if so, what are you observing?
So we're not, I wouldn't say we're keeping track. In preparation for this argument, we did reach out to the counties just to get a general idea of what's going on, because we don't see a lot of these cases on appeal. So what I can tell the court is, as far as appeals, because we get all the appeals into our office, we've only seen a handful, and I believe they were all pleas. We haven't seen a case where a defendant appealed after a trial yet. And this is the first case where we've seen the constitutionality of the statute being challenged. We took an informal survey just generally about how these cases are handled. We heard back from 10 counties, so a little less than half. We can tell the court the counties are certainly aware of the guidelines and that they have to consider these factors in determining the plea offer. We were not advised that there's any policies that are contrary to the guidelines or that any counties say we always give this amount or the numbers are not statistically significant to say that there's any kind of inter-county disparity at this point, and the Attorney General is not concerned about that at this point, and the defendant hasn't made any kind of showing that there is any kind of inter-county disparity.
Do your numbers, are they in sync with what Mr. Duard was sharing with us?
I heard some different numbers. Again, we may not have heard back from the same counties. And it was just an informal survey. I know there was at least one other county that had a 20-year case, pre-indictment. There were some cases that were 15. We have heard from some of the counties that even the 15, defendant balk at the 15-year offer. And again, it was just an informal survey, and we don't really
The numbers can only tell you so much.
Yes.
Do you agree that there is a role for the court to play in ensuring the uniform application of this act, and therefore trial judges must give a statement of reasons, just as we've required in Vasquez, as we've required in Brimage, as we required in the PTI cases? Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify, you said, just to be clear, prosecutor.
Prosecutor has to give a statement of reasons.
Yes, and I would also say that's what Vasquez says. And I would also say, just to clarify a little bit, Vasquez cites to a case, Gonzalez. It's an appellate division case which cites to Alvarez, so a similar context in the Graves Act waiver, and says that the statement of reasons is implicated when the defendant is making a claim of arbitrary and capricious. So I think that would be how this would come about. A defendant would make a claim that the prosecutor is arbitrary and capricious, and then the prosecutor...
Before there's a statement of reasons?
I'm
looking at Bremage. This is the court. To permit effective judicial review, prosecutors must state on the record their reasons for choosing to waive or not to waive the mandatory minimum period of parole eligibility specified in the statute. This read from Brimage. Mm-hmm. I read earlier from Dasquiz. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Yeah.
Like, why shouldn't that be required here?
I mean, the court could certainly require that. My only response to that would be if the defendant is not complaining or has no issue with the with the offer that's been given, a statement of reasons may not be necessary. And I think in the Alvarez context, which I think is analogous, the statement of reasons is triggered when the defendant makes some kind of claim about arbitrary and...
Doesn't the court have an independent obligation to determine whether to accept the plea? And therefore, without a statement of reasons by the prosecutor as to why, number one, he's waiving, mm-hmm. and how much he's waiving, how would the court be able to fulfill its judicial function?
The state, does not feel strongly that... let me be clear. Vasquez does suggest that there should be a statement of reasons, and, the state would not have a real issue if this court said that there should be a statement of reasons in cases. But it does make more sense that a defendant would have to make some kind of challenge to it, because if really what Vasquez says is that arbitrary and the standard is arbitrary and capricious to overturn a prosecutor's decision. If a defendant is not even alleging arbitrary and capricious, a judge wouldn't be finding arbitrary and capricious. It's the defendant's heavy burden to show arbitrary and capricious. If the defendant is perfectly happy with the 15-year plea deal, the 18-year plea deal, the 20-year plea deal, he's not going to make that showing. So there's not really anything for the judge to find.
The problem of waiting for the defendant to object, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to put a real-world gloss over this, mm-hmm. is if in the negotiations the defendant says, and I want you to give a statement of reasons, the prosecutor may say, you want a statement of reasons? Go to trial. You got 25. I mean, that's the problem. We either say you have a statement of reasons or the defendant is going to be really toothless in, mm-hmm. in these negotiations. No?
That could possibly be a concern. I would hope that prosecutors would not be doing that. But I do want to talk about the statement of reason, since we're bringing that up, and the level of detail, which was talked about before. I know defense counsel has suggested an in-camera review. The state doesn't see any need for that. The level of detail, the state can point to the objective facts in discovery and can talk in more general terms and still satisfy these guidelines and discuss these guidelines and give the court an opportunity to understand what the prosecutor's reasoning is without having to go into detail that would have to be in camera. So, for example, the prosecutor doesn't have to say in open court, the victim reported to me she's having nightmares thinking about having to face the defendant again. That level of detail is not required whatsoever. That might be the type of thing that's embarrassing to the victim, and the state certainly does not want to put out there, and that's not even necessary.
If the court were to go in the direction of requiring a statement of reasons, your concern is to make sure that we are sensitive, not to require very victim-sensitive matters to be required to be put on the record.
Absolutely. So something like that. The prosecutor doesn't have to say, the victim, every time I see her, she's shaking at the thought of, having to testify against the victim. The prosecutor can simply say, I've considered all the guidelines, and factors B, C, and D apply here, that the victim doesn't want, those concerns about the victim doesn't want to have to come to court and relive the encounter. That would satisfy that.
The examples you've given mm-hmm. are the types of, like, victim impact statements that are, like, typical. They're not unusual. Those are the types of statements that victims give so that the court knows to give an appropriate sentence. We see that all the time.
Perhaps.
I'm surprised by the examples you've given. I'm not saying that there isn't victim-sensitive material that should not go.
These are minors, though, correct?
Very young.
These
children.
Are minors.
These are very young children. So it's a little different from a victim
exactly.
statement from
and
an
if
adult,
a
don't you think?
Exactly. And if a victim chooses to share that information at sentencing, I think that's very different than a court requiring a prosecutor to, in open court or even in camera, to start talking about the victim's innermost thoughts and fears and their feelings about the whole process. I don't think by any means that should be required to satisfy these guidelines or uniformity. The degree of physical and emotional harm, the prosecutor can point to the facts in discovery. The strength of the case, again, the facts in discovery. All of these things are things that can be satisfied with a level of detail that is not re-victimizing the victim and his or her family. And that was absolutely done here. The prosecutor, in opposition to the defendant's motion to remove the matter from sentencing under Jessica Lunsford Act, recounted what this crime was all about. This was a years of abuse by a quasi-stepfather against his, you know, a minor child. And again, a unique case where the abuse is actually caught on video. So the prosecutor more than justified under these guidelines why the 20 years was appropriate. And I think it's important to discuss what defendant's alleged claim was for the arbitrary and capricious and why he was entitled to less. He made two arguments below. The first was that the guidelines permit a 15-year sentence recommendation. Just to be clear, the guidelines do not require prosecutors to offer 15 years pre-indictment. They reserve the 15 years for pre-indictment, but they in no means require a 15-year pre-indictment offer. And I think even defense counsel's representations today show that they're not all, I'm not sure if he clarified that they were all pre-indictment, but there's no requirement that it has to be 15 years. And again, the legislature, Justice LaVecchia said this before, set the standard at 25 years to life. This is a reduction that benefits everyone. It benefits victims and their families. It benefits the system as a whole because not every case has to go to trial. And it benefits defendants in appropriate cases. And for those reasons, you know, the state submits that it is appropriate and constitutional. And again, as far as the statement of reasons, I just want to make clear, nothing in Vasquez talks about any type of written statement of reasons. It just says on the record. The prosecutor here did give written reasons in opposition to the defendant's motion on three separate occasions, but nothing requires any type of written statement, formal statement of reasons. This is not a PTI type of situation. This is a situation where it would have to be on the record to the extent the court says it would have to be in every case.
Would you object to it, to having to get the statement of reasons in writing to the judge before sentencing?
I don't think Vasquez requires it. I think that would be an extension of Vasquez. So the state would say that we should follow Vasquez, which would be an on-the-record statement of reasons, and that would be sufficient.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Just one other point. So the defendant made two claims about the arbitrary and capricious. Number one was that the guidelines somehow required a 15-year sentence. That's not the case. And second, he said that his lack of criminal record should have been considered. And I just wanted to point out that is not a factor under these guidelines because, again, this is not defendant-focused, it's victim-focused, but that actually works both ways because the state can't point to a defendant who's, you know, has an abysmal criminal record and use that against that defendant. So similarly, a defendant can't point to a lack of criminal record and say that they're entitled to maximum leniency, which is what the defendant is asking for here, and it's his burden. I can't emphasize enough. It is his burden, as this court said in Ligaris, to meet the heavy burden of showing that. I just want to get the language because I think it's very important. We emphasize the burden on defendant to prove a prosecutor's decision to deny leniency constituted an arbitrary and capricious exercise of discretion is heavy. Defendants will have to do more than merely make conclusory statements that a prosecutorial determination was was abusive. Instead, they must clearly and convincingly, they must show clearly and convincingly their entitlement to relief under the standard established herein. And just a final note, I would say, the defendant did get leniency here. He got substantial leniency. He got 5 years off of his sentence. He has not shown in any way, shape, or form that the prosecutor was arbitrary and capricious in not giving him maximum leniency. Unless the court has any other questions, the state would ask that the appellate division be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Duard, rebuttal?
Just a couple of very brief clarifications. In the first place, the uniformity requirement is, in fact, part of the statute, and it was discussed below. In fact, the hearing prosecutor in his brief got that wrong. He said that it is not part of the statute, but the statute itself, subsection D, does require guidelines in order to ensure uniformity. And on that point, we can do a much more extensive analysis of cases in New Jersey across the counties. All but one of the cases I did refer to were pre-indictment. We can do a much more extensive analysis of those cases and provide that to the court if that's what this court wants me to do. It's not a problem. Secondly, just on a clarification point, I think the Attorney General was referring to the trial counsel and what happened at the trial counsel. I don't believe I asked for the minimum sentence, possible sentence for ATC, just either to find the statute, the JLA, unconstitutional because of subsection D, or if this court wishes to do a Vasquez type of approach, probably granting the state's point about the confidentiality, probably some kind of my suggestion was an in-camera hearing. There might be other possibilities, providing the judge with the reasons before sentencing, provide those just to the judge. There might be other possibilities, but that would provide the court with a Vasquez type of solution rather than finding, if this court does not want to find the JLA unconstitutional on these grounds.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. No need for any submissions unless you hear from the clerk of the court.
Thank you.
All right.